Hi, this is Nicole Hensoth, editor of HPC Wire, here with today's edition of Soundbite, our daily interview series featuring researchers, thought leaders, and newsmakers in the world of high-performance computing. On today's edition of Soundbite, we'll be talking with Jason Stowe, CEO of HPC cloud computing company Cycle Computing. We've covered a number of their use cases in HPC Wire in the past that were noteworthy because of scale and application complexity, and recently we just described some unique middleware they've developed called Jupyter that's generated some interest for some of you out there. So we thought we'd have him on to share some more detail about that and the larger future of HPC clouds for that matter. So hi, Jason.
Hey, Nicole. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. So I think many of our readers are already familiar with what Cycle Computing does, but for those who aren't, can you spend about 2 minutes giving an overview of the work you do in HPC specific to clouds? I know you use Amazon as the backbone for what you do.
Yeah, so we essentially, at the beginning of the day, we wake up in the morning excited about one primary area, and that is that, customers in our space are really asking for utility access to technical computing environments. When I used to work at the Pittsburgh Supercomputing Center or the Cornell Theory Center back in the day, getting new systems in and making it very easy to access technical computing resources was very difficult. And our fundamental belief is that by making these very accessible, we make it so that more and more people can do innovative and inventive work, and that this is going to be the single largest driver of invention over the next couple of decades. So we write software that essentially makes it very easy to do what we call orchestration, which is the creation of various forms of technical computing environments across a mix of internal and external resources. So we're able to take for a majority of the 8 largest pharma, 3 of the 5 largest life insurance and annuity companies, 2 of the 3 largest next-gen sequencing companies, and a number of others, make it so that their workloads run on a mix of internal computing and external computing. And we actually were kind of the first ones doing this thanks to cloud starting back in 2007 with a Cycle Cloud product that we have around orchestration. So that's essentially what we believe and what we do.
I know that we've published, like I said, a number of your case studies. Which to you is the most impressive as far as the scale or application complexity goes?
Well, they're all different in slightly different ways, but I think, obviously I'm the latest and greatest is always a fond one. But before that, I would say, we were really excited about the million-hour genomic research that we did as part of the Big Science Challenge with the Mortgage Institute of Research, where they had a 78 terabyte data set for making it much easier for researchers to determine whether stem cells had turned into the types of cells that they wanted them to turn into for the purposes of replicating a disease and trying to figure out how to treat it. That was a very interesting one because it was essentially about 115 years of computing and million hours that we did in a week. As a result of being able to take advantage of approximately 8,000 to 10,000 cores on average over that week 10 time frame in the cloud. And essentially, it was a big data meets big compute kind of use case. And maybe one of the other more recent ones was last February. We did a 10,000 server cluster, which Novartis came out and talked about at Amazon reInvent this past November. They actually took credit for that run originally, but weren't able to use their name. But essentially, they did cancer research on about 10,000 servers that we spun up, ran approximately 40 years of science in that case in about 11 hours. And, the total cost for doing that, instead of buying a $44 million environment, which is, what a 10,000 server environment typically runs, it was approximately $4,370 or something like that. To do that 40 years of science. And that actually came up with 3 drugs that made their way into the wet lab. So 3 candidates actually that the computational science found worked their way into their wet lab process to become potential drugs against cancer, which was really exciting. So I have a fondness for all of them. Everybody that we've talked about publicly that is doing unique and innovative work, but those are 2 of the more recent ones that weren't the largest one that we just talked about this last November that were particularly exciting.
Right. And you've really done a good job of proving what the crowd is capable of for applications like this, which is a story in itself. So how has that software layer that you've developed evolved over the years? You said you've been around for how many years again? And where did you start software-wise? And let's lead up to Jupyter, where you are now.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you got it. That sounds great. So we got started in 2005. My first three clients were J.P. Morgan Chase, Hartford Insurance Group, and Lockheed Martin. Actually, not in that order. Hartford was our first client. So we essentially started by helping people do utility access on internal environments and making internal computing run robustly. And we used we did a lot of work with at the time the open source schedulers. Condor, which does an excellent job of doing complicated matchmaking and policy making at large internal scales. And so a majority of our work in those areas was essentially on various forms of batch computation that needed to be done. It was not a set of MPI workloads like what I had used in the past when I was at some of the supercomputing centers. These were more, you know, edge or new HPC use cases where people were essentially trying to solve complicated problems that involved some form of Monte Carlo simulation. So they did have beefy problems, but they also had a lot of them. So essentially we started there, and in 07 what we realized was a lot of our customer base followed a similar pattern. They essentially had a peak versus median utilization problem. So, you know, they were able to buy a certain amount of hardware, but then they were almost imprisoned by it, right? So essentially, the questions they asked from then on out generally tended to be the size that would fit inside the servers they already owned rather than, you know, the right question or the right problem to be posing. And so what we saw the cloud as being a potential for solving this problem, because users could get access when they needed to. And this is, you know, it doesn't happen every day, but when you need it, you can be able to reach in and grab, you know, 156,000 cores and do some real work with it. And that we thought was a huge potential. And obviously we didn't know how big this was going to get in terms of scale, but we did know that even just being able to grab 40 cores with a 15-minute overhead of, you know, spinning up everything and having it work, you know, a lot of great science gets done at small scales. So that's when we started working on CycleCloud, and largely our first implementations were in that range. So, you know, we did work in 2008 with a scientific instrument manufacturer, Varian Inc., that got bought by Agilent later. Essentially, they were running a 432-core cluster to do 6 weeks' worth of computing internally, but instead we got it done in 18 hours. And at the time, the only reason we didn't get it done faster was because, there's a mental block around, you know, renting 1,600 cores to do something at the time, and in 2008 was a pretty foreign concept. And then we moved through, you know, essentially dealing with scale problems as we started getting a lot of pharma customers. As I mentioned, one of the things we always try to do when we talk about these technologies is talk about the customer work that they're driving. So in 08 and 09 and in 2010, we essentially started dealing with a lot of life science organizations, a lot of pharma. And a lot of their problems had, you know, these large needle in the haystack problems where you want to be able to sort through a massive amount of data and run simulations against it. So it's a kind of a combination of compute and big data in order to find the right answers. So in addition to doing the work on managing the cluster and making it very easy to submit workloads to it, which is what CycleServer does, we now had CycleCloud, which would provision these environments and do all the orchestration and security and what have you. And to that last piece, we essentially added something called Data Manager, and we spun that out as its own separate product in earlier last year and the year before. So in 2012, I think we separated it officially and had essentially something that moved the data around between your internal environment and the external environment. There really wasn't a cloud scheduler, something that was commercially available that would both do bandwidth allocation and round robin on the various people that needed to move data, but also keep audit trail records and use the right protocols to get data between, you know, different endpoints like your file system or S3 or nowadays Glacier. So that was the last piece. And then essentially the problems that we started getting from our customer base got larger and larger. So, you know, these peak questions can be quite cumbersome, even if, you know, with 10,000 cores, they might take a couple of weeks to run. So essentially, we wanted to be able to hit much, much higher scales. And for that purpose, we essentially designed Jupyter, because we see in our customer base a larger amount of interactive and large scale streaming workloads, where you're either, you know, have a very large bolus of work that needs to be done, or you have a large stream of work that's pretty bursty that may need to be done. And you don't want to have large scheduling overhead on doing it. You don't really care about a lot of the features that things like Grid Engine and Slurm and what have you and Condor are really great at in terms of fair share and various aspects of resource allocation. In these environments, you actually care more about the scheduling overhead, that it's very low and that you can hit high scales. Traditionally, you know, a lot of the low overhead scheduler or service-oriented architecture type stuff like Symfony, you know, really doesn't scale past 10,000 to 40,000 cores. It's a common problem. So we needed to be able to hit, you know, six-digit core counts, and we wrote Jupyter specifically to be able to do that. And that's essentially been the progression, I think, since we started in terms of our product base, where we started out with SQL Server, and that eventually, you know, enabled Burst and submission to be transparent to the end user, where we, you know, added on SQL Cloud to essentially handle the problems of being able to, you know, orchestrate technical computing environments, whether it's a cluster or a file system. Data Manager does the data movement, and Jupyter is now meant for essentially the low overhead task distribution at you know, everything from a couple hundred cores to hundreds of thousands.
And we recently talked a little bit about Jupyter and what some of the advantages are. I think what generated the most curiosity among our readers of that article was, how does this actually work? I mean, there are a lot of features here that it almost seem, we called it an out-of-this-world scheduler because it does some interesting things. So you've got distributed regions where you can, in an automated or manual way, power down servers in different regions if you're not getting enough juice for those. You can run everything on a very small number of management servers. Is that so? And if so, how does that work exactly?
Sure, yeah. So first, the distributed regions, yes, the workload is definitely large, high throughput or distributed workloads, things that are pleasantly parallel. The second issue is the management node overhead. So I think we had 14 management nodes for the 16,788 servers that were run in the mega run, the run we talked about in November. So to give a brief summary of that, you know, that was the essentially a large-scale material science problem. Each individual job in itself was actually an MPI job that used many cores. We had about 2 million individual tasks to analyze about 205,000 individual materials. These materials, you know, the total runtime for these 205,000 materials is about 2.3 million hours of computing. And essentially, the problem at hand was to run that in as short a time period and as cost effectively as possible. So we ended up with, I think, about an 18-hour runtime or 19-hour runtime, 17. And essentially, the head node problem is one that, you know, we essentially have two parts to the system. So there's a large distributed queue that is resilient. So this is one of the features that's, you know, we're somewhat excited about, especially when it comes to, for example, like financial services or healthcare workloads that may need to be, you know, particularly resilient. In that cluster, we actually could have lost any two servers, any two AZs, or any two regions of data centers, and had the entire workload finish in the remaining regions. And in fact, we actually did shut down two regions, the Australian and Brazilian regions, early on in the mega run, were terminated because we just weren't getting the compute per dollar out of them that we were hoping we would get. So as a result, we actually tested that resiliency issue, and those parts of the workloads ran elsewhere. So from a how it works perspective, you know, essentially this large distributed queue handles ensuring that in a resilient way, there's a record of exactly who's working on what that doesn't have to that doesn't require one particular node to be up. It's more of a peer-based system than a centralized, you know, kind of master-based system. The other parts of the system essentially are all based on, you know, very low overhead task distribution. So the system is actually designed to work really well, you know, with schedulers like Grid Engine and Condor and Slurm and what have you. You can actually have the workers of this system, the things that are executing parts of the workload, be running inside of other more traditional resource allocation schedulers, so that they essentially have a certain amount of resources that are allocated to them, and they use them as wisely as possible to run the individual tasks. In this case, I have to be a little bit careful about all the details of what we're going into here, but essentially we have a design point and an actual performance that's designed to be, you know, far less than a second per task to do the distribution. So at ideal intervals, it's in the milliseconds to at most hundreds of milliseconds, low hundreds of milliseconds range. In order to allocate and transfer a task to a node, have it worked on and transferred back, the overhead portion of that calculation is designed to be very low.
That makes it a little more of a fit than for financial services firms and those who are a little more interested in speed, correct?
Well, and I think you'll find actually that a lot of the newer forms of science are going to use this feature a lot. So, as an example, there's a lot of different interactive use cases where folks want to be able to have potentially large numbers of users kicking off various forms of calculation, some of which are very short in duration, and enable an interactive response back from the computing environment to the end user. So that it's the microwave phenomenon, right? That we always want things done faster, and I think from a practical standpoint, there's not just the runtime and compressing that, and that's where tools like the latest Ivy Bridge processors or your Phi or your Tesla or what have you come in handy on the runtime side. But there's also the overhead of getting the task out, getting it back, and having that be as interactive as possible. Those are other use cases that we think there's going to be a lot of over time, because assisting the actual researcher while they're doing the research, rather than having it be an offline batch process, having it be an inline real-time process, can potentially make people far more productive.
Right. And you mentioned also something about a method to productize or commercialize the Jupyter technology. Can you describe that a little?
Yeah, so essentially we haven't released this publicly for download yet. We will be making it available this year, early in this year. But essentially what we're wanting to do, obviously, is our goal at the end of the day is to have as big an impact as possible in accelerating humanity's ability to invent new and amazing technologies and solutions and products and treatments, ideally for disease. And so our fundamental driver is the desire to accelerate the human mind, right? If you think about it in that sense. So we want this to have as wide an access model as possible. So we're obviously trying to balance, being able to pay the developers that are doing amazing engineering work. Cycle has the good fortune of having a world-class, engineering group that has consistently shown they can do things that no one else can do in the areas of computation, specifically on cloud. And so, what I want to do is obviously still continue to be able to fund those guys to be able to make this technology better, add features to it, make it more applicable. But I definitely think we're looking very heavily at trying to have an open component around it so that there's an easy way for people to be able to benefit from this and not have to worry, just be able to download it and use it. So we're still balancing. Obviously, this kind of question is always a hard problem. But we are very excited about getting this into folks' hands and having them, able to run with it and use it to do, more and more real workloads. We're definitely excited about the use cases it enables. And we just have to figure out the right balance of, the commercial side of how do we actually make this a viable offering and the open side of, is this freely available? Can people just download it and use it? So that's what we're working on right now.
Great. Great. Well, I can attest to this. You are at a number of industry events, and you're very approachable, so people that have questions can just come right up and ask you. That's useful. All right, Jason, thanks for being on. We'll keep track of this progress and check in with you again later in the year.
Nicole, thanks. As always, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you.